Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Steve Burris, president of Rex Healthcare, about community-based hospitals, quality versus quantity.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking with the leader of a major community-based hospital. I think there's over 5,000 employees. And we talk a lot about academic hospitals, but when we talk about community-based hospitals of all sizes, it's a slightly different beast, and we're going to hear about that beast, and hopefully it'll be beauty and beast.
Hopefully, beauty. Exactly. I'm looking forward to that. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about additional radiation to lymph nodes in relationship with breast cancer recurrence or improvement.
We're going to be talking about NSAIDs, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent, and for kidney disease or hypertension, maybe a no-no. We'll talk about it.
We'll talk about chemotherapy and quality of life at the end of life. Is it helpful or harmful?
And then finally, we're going to talk about, you know, when you or a loved one has a stroke and you get in the hospital and the hospital says they can get you that medication to dissolve the stroke within an hour. Are they really telling you the truth? We'll find out.
All right. First, we're going to talk about this radiation for breast cancer. So currently, most women who have breast cancer are treated with breast-conserving surgery followed by radiation to the whole breast. So radiation is a standard part of the treatment. But one of the questions this study is looking at is whether the addition of radiation to the lymph nodes nearby would improve outcomes.
So this was a study that was done in Canada over 14 years following 1,800 patients, also with colleagues in the United States and Australia. And they were really trying to determine, just as you say, Christy, does this additional radiation, does it actually improve survival? And does it lead to a reduction in breast cancer recurrence? And the answer is it doesn't really increase overall survival. But it does perhaps give it a reduced local recurrence when it's given to the lymph nodes. And what do you think?
Well, there's a lot of complexity to these questions about what kind of breast cancer it was, and is it the breast cancer that typically takes one's life or not. But it's positive in that if it decreases the chance of recurrence, that is a positive outcome. And maybe if they followed it, they followed it for 14 years, but it's possible that if they followed it longer that you might see a difference in mortality.
Right. And so this was also women who had positive cancer in the lymph nodes, or they were maybe lymph node negative, but they were high risk. The cancer was a bad cancer. So the cancers that you kind of worry more about. And the question is, does this additional radiation have the benefit? Because there are risks of additional radiation, including scarring of the lungs, increased problems with edema or swelling in the arms from where the radiation was.
Sure. But, I mean, I would need to have more information to guide a single patient. And thankfully, we have specialists and consultants to work with. But I think a lot of women would take those risks in order to not have a recurrence, even though you can't show that necessarily they'll live longer.
Right. I think this is one of the things where a decision tool could be helpful because I think you're right, Christy. If it's said to my wife or my mother or someone that, you know, you're going to have less recurrence if you have this, someone go, great. But then someone says, well, but you're not going to live any longer. And then I'd say, and there's going to be potential side effects. I might say, wait a second. So I think this is one where you have to weigh the pros and the cons.
Yep. Sure.
Let's talk about our next research that matters that perhaps isn't quite as complicated but is really common, and that's these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that people take. But maybe if they have high blood pressure, they better be cautious.
Yeah. So we've known from previous research that there is a relationship between taking these anti-inflammatory drugs like Advil, Motrin, ibuprofen, Naprosyn, what am I missing?
Nupren. Anything
prims.
That's an N.
Okay. And a relationship between taking those, especially if you take them chronically or all the time, to impaired kidney function when your kidneys don't work quite as well. But it's tricky to tease out the also other reasons for for kidney problems that are related to high blood pressure, which can raise one's risk of having kidney damage just from the blood pressure alone.
And so this was research that was published in the journal called Hypertension. Seems like a good appropriate name for the journal. And 30,000 people who had hypertension and who had been taking these anti-inflammatory agents for at least 3 months were actually a third more likely to have chronic kidney disease. And if they took it more than once a day, they had a 23% chance of this chronic kidney disease than people who didn't use them. These are pretty significant findings.
Yeah, they didn't take the blood test to really measure exactly what the kidney impairment was, how much it was. Some of the way that they did the study leaves some questions that need to be answered. But it does suggest that taking these anti-inflammatories, if you have high blood pressure and the length of time that you take them, plays some role in increased risk of chronic kidney disease. So I would say if you have high blood pressure, you want to talk to your doctor and be thoughtful about just like popping random Advil here and there. Be thoughtful about it.
Yeah, I'm not so certain that an occasional pill would have the same effect, but certainly daily medication, this should be a caution. And maybe really talk to your doctor about it if you need other anti-inflammatory agents, perhaps not these types of medicines. Let's talk about our next research that matters, Christy, about chemotherapy and quality of life at the end of life, a very difficult topic.
It is a very difficult topic. And a lot of times when people are at the end of life, and even when physicians predict and the team predicts that a person will die and that they're at the end of their life, chemotherapy is still offered because of the thought that it might improve their quality of life. Maybe they'll have less pain, or maybe there's some element that might impact them in a positive way.
Yeah, and this was actually from the American Society of Clinical Oncology expert panel. And they looked at how this chemotherapy, the end of life, is related to how well your performance status is when you get it. So how well can you walk? How well can you do your work and handle your daily activities? Thinking, well, maybe the people might benefit who are more functional. And it didn't actually turn out that way at all.
No. And not only did the chemotherapy not benefit the patient, so it wasn't associated with them living longer, and it didn't improve the quality of life, but it also showed some poor ability to perform their daily functions and some harm with patients who already had a low ability of activities of daily living.
Right. So those who had poor functional, maybe as expected, chemotherapy in their life didn't help them. But the people who were pretty physically robust at the time they had this, it actually lowered their quality of life. So it suggests that if you are towards the end of your life, saying that you might benefit from this is actually not intellectually honest. You actually are most likely to do worse. And that information, I think, is one that people probably need to hear, but this is one of those articles. When I first read it, Christy, I went, whoa, this is hard, but it's important.
Yeah, it's a hard decision to not take chemotherapy, especially if your function is good. But really thinking about what your goals are and sharing that decision with your providers is important. Lastly, hospitals overestimate the time it takes to give what we call clot-busting drugs or thrombolytics, which are given to people when they have the kind of stroke that is like a clot. And we give these blood medications to then break up that clot, and it matters how quickly you get them.
Right. So if you need to get this ideally within 3 hours and even sooner if you have the type of stroke that could benefit. And this research in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed that a lot of the people representing these hospitals said, oh, sure, we can do that in under an hour. Matter of fact, it's like, name that tune. I can do it in 3 lines. I can do it in 50 minutes. And it turns out that they actually can't quite do it as fast as they say they can, many of the ones, particularly if they don't do a lot of procedures.
Right. And it is true that some of this is based on what they have documented. There are some barriers of when the patient actually comes to the emergency department. There are also some barriers in who is allowed to order these medications, because there are harms to them. You don't want to just give it to everyone who might randomly have the possibility of a stroke. It's important to make a good, quick assessment and make good decisions. So there are a bunch of different barriers, but you should know that if you're having those symptoms of slurred speech and things that make you worry, that you might be having a stroke, you really want to call 911 immediately, get to the hospital as quickly as possible and ask about these medications or have your family members do it.
Yeah, if you're really having a stroke, don't call up your primary care doctor and say, I need to get in sometime in the next 2 days. Not going to do it. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We've had a good chance to talk about the need to get accurate and reliable information about how quickly you can get the drugs that might benefit you if you are having a stroke or in the hospital.
About chemotherapy and quality of life at the end of life.
About potentially really avoiding the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs if you do have chronic kidney disease.
And about an additional radiation to the lymph node reduces breast cancer recurrence for some patients. That does conclude the research that matters.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Steve Burris, president of Rex Healthcare, about community-based hospitals, quality versus quantity. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Steve Burris, president of Rex Healthcare, about community-based hospitals, quality versus quantity.
Welcome, Mr. Burris. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, help us understand and give us a little introduction of yourself for our listeners. What was it about your journey that led you to be a leader in a large, successful community-based hospital?
I'm originally from Charleston, West Virginia, and growing up in, I'll say, a challenged economy, there were only parts of the business segment that were thriving in West Virginia. And one of those was an institution known as Charleston Area Medical Center. And as I grew up, I could see that it was thriving, and also happened to know the president of the organization at the time. So I followed his career path as well as the progress of the organization. And over time, I realized, hey, this is really an interesting career option for me because it puts together some aspects of really big business, but also business with a mission. And that was really what got me interested in healthcare. I wasn't particularly interested in being a physician, but some relationship to healthcare sparked my interest.
You know, when we think about community-based hospitals, it's very different than the academic health center. You know, Christy and I have practiced most of our adult professional lives, and we present research frequently conducted in academic health centers. Help our listeners around the state, around the country, understand what are community-based hospitals, how do they differ, and in many respects, how are they the same?
Good question. So it depends on the size of the community. There's so many community hospitals that have sprung up, and really there were certain incentives over the years of the government to develop hospitals within certain communities, and they serve a purpose very important to the local residents. That is that they provide really basic good health care close to home, and they leave the really complicated quaternary things for the academic medical centers. Academic medical centers can't fill up with routine care. They need to take care of those very complicated things. So community hospitals end up being large employers in the areas where they are, and an important part overall to really the economy of any city that they are located in. But they're different. Rex, where I happen to work, is somewhere in between what I would say a community hospital and academic medical center. We take care of very complicated patients, tertiary-type patients. We're more of a referral center than the typical community hospital. So our role is somewhere in between community hospital and academic medical center.
And you're located over – and you serve the area of Raleigh, North Carolina, large catchment area of couple hundred thousand people in that area.
Over a million people in the county alone.
A lot of people moved in there since I last lived.
As you look across our state, and I imagine this is true across the nation, a lot of the more rural community hospitals and smaller hospitals are – becoming attached to these larger academic health centers or even larger private hospitals that have multiple little hospitals as a part of that. What do you think are the benefits of that? And then what are the risks to those communities and to those hospitals being able to thrive?
Well, without a doubt, smaller rural community hospitals are struggling. Over 50 have closed since 2010. And as healthcare gets more complicated, as the payment systems change, and as the reimbursement is either flattening or decreasing, those community hospitals are looking for really, I think, protection from the larger academic medical centers or through the academic medical centers. For instance, an academic medical center like UNC can do is come into a community, elevate the type of care, the level of sophistication of care that's being provided there, and at the same time help them with standardization, protocols, and ways to operate more efficiently so they can elevate the care and then make it also more able to sustain itself.
You know, I heard in North Carolina that a decade ago, there were 115, 120 hospitals that served something like 75, you know, at least different, you know, local. So a lot of local hospitals. And that today, that number may be slightly smaller. Not, the overall number hasn't decreased. But like you just mentioned, it's only maybe 25 or 30 different health systems. So all the hospitals have gotten bought up. Is that actually improving the quality of care for people across the state, or are there concerns that people are getting too big?
There's both sides of the argument. I do think it really is improving care. And for instance, many of the health systems right now are focused on trying to decrease mortality as a result of sepsis.
So what infections, common infections, people come in the hospital, major killer of people.
That's right. And if not quickly identified, things can go south very fast. But when you use the scale and the scope of a large academic system, you can create protocols, you can create interventions that happen sooner, and you can spread those across all the community hospitals that are part of the system. And really what you see is a change in mortality, and we're actually seeing that across the state with this particular issue, sepsis.
And we were just talking earlier about the time to delivery of some of the clot busters for people who have strokes. So that's another initiative that can be done maybe on a broader scale. How about from what the community hospitals can teach and give to these larger healthcare systems? There's something in community engagement and trust and relationships that must be taught back, I would imagine.
Over the years, as I said, community hospitals really are sort of a fabric of the areas that they serve. Through that, establish relationships. And so they're very, very relationship oriented. And I think it's unique to community hospitals. But I will also say that community hospitals in general have a lower Medicare reimbursement rate. So for every patient that comes in, they get paid less than, let's say, the big academic centers. That's because they don't participate in teaching and other programs like that increase the rate. So community hospitals learn to live on a leaner reimbursement. Hmm. As a result, they operate generally more efficiently. They are light on bureaucracy. More adaptable to change because they've just had to learn to survive that way over the years. And so I think that's a great way how the community hospitals can actually help the academic centers, because we've had to learn to live with a lean reimbursement for years.
Are there certain things that you think have started, certain ideas and innovations that have actually started in community-based hospitals that because it sounds like you also can experiment perhaps more nimbly?
I think that's true. People would generally be surprised in this community hospital that I work at any point in time. We have around 40 oncology research studies underway and about 40 in heart and vascular services. And then one of the things we have done as an organization is start an angel fund or a venture fund. We've taken a small portion of our reserves and set it aside to help support innovation in the community. So we're trying to draw out those entrepreneurs in the community, or either physicians or trying to promote some healthcare idea, and help them get started. And so at this point, I think we've invested in around 7 different companies that have a healthcare-related mission to help support some sort of innovation in healthcare. It's very unique.
Do you think that helps you recruit different types of physicians or providers, people who want to be more innovative? Or is this the culture of what you're doing is really sustaining?
I certainly think it will help attract people. We're fairly new into it, so it's hard to conclude that that's one of the outcomes that we're going to see. But it is certainly – there's an energy about it that has helped, I think, advance other ideas through the hospital and opened up individuals' minds to, hey, maybe there is a different way to do things.
Can you share one project that's going forward that people would know about or that you hope people know about it soon?
Well, sure. I'll share one. The name of the company is Phenonics, and one of the issues that hospitals struggle with and we all struggle with it from a regulatory standpoint, is refrigeration temperatures. Mm-hmm. And Phenonics has a new product that's out. It actually doesn't use a compressor in creating a cool environment in a refrigerator. And so, therefore, medical products can be stored with less variation in temperature as doors are open and closed and things like that over time. So it's a local company. I wish I could explain how the thing works, but it involves.
We're going to trust you on this one too.
Over my head, but that's one of the companies we've invested.
Sure. So that's both investing in the community as a local company and also improving the stability of those drugs. You'd have less waste, less things you have to throw away because the refrigeration got off. That's exciting. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be continuing to talk with our guest, Steve Burris, president of Rex Healthcare, about community-based hospitals, quality versus quantity. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Steve Burris, president of Rex Healthcare, about community-based hospitals, quality versus quantity. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about partnering with local business and innovation to improve quality in hospitals. And we've alluded to it, but there's a lot of talk about the importance of community engagement for all hospitals. But could you give us some examples of one, what does community engagement mean from a community hospital standpoint, and maybe some examples of ways that your hospital partners with the community or is engaged?
Sure. As I mentioned, community hospitals are typically one of the largest employers in their area, and there's obligations that come with that. We work hard to make sure that we're serving the communities around us in a way that fits what their needs are. So, for example, downtown Raleigh or southeast Raleigh in our area is one of the challenged parts of the neighborhood economically, and there's not adequate health care. And Rex for years has sponsored a center down there called the Rex Senior Health Center, where we've served really a medically underserved population, predominantly all seniors, a group. And we lose a good bit of money doing this every year, but we see a certain sense of obligation to make sure that we are taking care of the entire community. Recently, the building that center was in was being sold, and we had to find a way to relocate. And we were fortunate for many, many years to have subsidized rent to where we were only paying minuscule amount of money for this facility. But we found a way to work with another local agency called Wake Health Services and actually expand what we're doing and our commitment to the seniors in Southeast Raleigh. And so I think looking for partnerships with organizations in the community to find a way to offer a broader scope of services and serve bigger populations is really important going forward.
You know, it's one of the larger institutions within a community, the hospital is, and that you mentioned the economic role. And you just mentioned this kind of obligation to extend the hospital boundaries. I'm sure that there's challenges and pressures of how far you can extend, both in terms of physically, but also your mission. And I'm thinking about some of the things I've seen in hospitals where you now have farmers markets coming into the hospital, and your mission is to ensure that people eat appropriately. And you've got music going in hospitals because people, when they hear music, seem to have better outcomes. How do you transform to these new roles? Do you have some examples of some things you've been able to do in some of your work?
Sure. So there's no doubt the models and everything behind healthcare is sort of changing the reimbursement models. So we're trying to shift. And it sounds almost perverse, but from a position to where we take care of people who are acutely ill to where we're trying to keep people from ever having to use our facilities. And that is a huge shift that's going to take place over the next 10 years or the next two decades. I don't know how long it will take before we think we've achieved that. But also within that, there's a growing recognition. There's a lot of things that go into what makes up an individual's health. One of the things I'm proud of that we do, it's a little bit unique, is our food services within Rex Healthcare. They have been featured in GQ, a number of Condé Nast and other things like that for how good the food is at Rex. We made a commitment several years ago to take all of the deep fryers out of Rex Healthcare, so you will not have anything that's fried. The ingredients that that make up your meal will be fresh ingredients and not processed food. We actually have an herb garden as part of the hospital in the courtyard. And so we try to make sure that we're not only talking about proper eating habits, but that we're practicing that ourselves. And when you're in the hospital, you have a menu you can choose healthy items from. And I will tell you, it's a differentiator for us, without a doubt.
Can we come there? Can we come to the meal there? Christy and I can have lunch there just because, I mean, if we have a choice between there and in a restaurant with the fried food, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you.
Maybe get a picture of the garden for our listeners to look at, too.
Absolutely. Quick story. There's a competition within North Carolina called Gotta Be NC. And it's an Iron Chef-like competition between local restaurants. And the Rex chefs, we have five Culinary Institute of America-trained chefs, entered the competition this year. And restaurant by restaurant by restaurant won the competition. And so now in October, they will be competing for the North Carolina champion, I guess, restaurant. Which is amazing, and I feel bad for the people that have to compete against us, because if you win, people say, "Well, you beat a hospital, big deal." And if you lose, well, you lost to the hospital. Come on,
yeah.
It's a win-win or lose-lose, depending on how you look at it.
So we're really trying to change the reputation of hospital food.
Right. Well, and no one wants to be in the hospital per se for most reasons. So it's nice that you're putting some emphasis in making it as healthy and positive experience as possible. Thinking about your statement about us needing to keep people out of the hospital and that ultimately being the goal, there's also a tension currently in that that's part of what keeps hospitals going is having patients who are there.
Yes.
How do you look ahead and move forward of what we know is the mission to keep people out, but also maintaining a vibrant and reliable and sustainable financial model?
And then also, when you go to this new model, how are you going to make your money?
Yeah. I mean,
if I had the answer to this, I would be on the national speaking circuit and selling a lot of books and hopefully retired in a couple of years. So it is absolutely a challenge to figure out. You want to move at the pace at which this is moving. If you get too far ahead of it, you're going to be hurt financially. And if you're too far behind it, you're going to miss an opportunity and probably not do well as an organization. So we're striving for that balance. And one of the ways we do that is a big investment in primary care. Right now in the area, while Wake County is a very affluent area, if you're a Medicare patient, it is very hard to find a physician. And so if you don't have a primary care physician, you're going to use the emergency department and other expensive means of health care to help you manage your care. So we want to make sure that we're expanding primary care, making sure that people have a medical home of some sort where they can be taken care of. Other things you do is you try to focus on those people who are regularly using your services sort of in an inappropriate way, and you kind of pull them aside and help with some intervention that will get them into the right avenue or the right aspect of healthcare where their care can better be managed. So a lot of it is that big investment in primary care and then sizing your specialist and your hospital around that. So people are trying to develop big networks, trying to take care of large populations of people so that they're able to feed the existing machines, the hospitals that exist today, and that those don't suffer.
We're talking with Steve Burris, president of Rex Healthcare, about community-based hospitals. And Steve, you are also personally involved in many organizations, I know. What drives your personal passion for getting engaged? And tell us about one or two things that are most meaningful to you when you do your own volunteer work.
Sure. The I think any successful organization has an obligation to give back to the community. Rex has over 5,700 coworkers, and so we take seriously that obligation. These are people with good, steady jobs, and there's a lot that we can do as a body of people in the community. For me personally, I'm involved in the Chamber of Commerce as a large employer. I'm involved in the North Carolina Symphony because I think that's an important cause, the arts, but also things that are really related to healthcare. And the biggest killers in America are cancer and heart disease. And so I spend my time on those two things because they're what's important to healthcare, and they're really what affects our community from a healthcare perspective. And then also Rex delivers over 6,000 babies a year, and so I'm active with the March for Babies.
You're not delivering babies?
No.
Well, thank you so much, Steve, for taking the time with us today and for the leadership that you're providing in your community and to teach us about the investment community hospitals are making now and in the future.
Well, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Steve Burris, president of Rex Healthcare, about community-based hospitals, quality versus quantity. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call today about summer colds.
I got a wicked head cold a few weeks ago, runny and stuffy nose, sore throat, and a cough. I drank lots of fluids, rested, and took some cold medicine. But halfway through a hot bowl of soup, it struck me as odd that I had bundled myself up in a blanket with my soup when it was 100 degrees outside. So my question is there anything special you should do when you get a cold during the summer?
That's a really great question, and it's one of those odd feelings when you know it's so hot outside, and yet all you want to do is be in a blanket and eat warm soup. And part of that has to do when you have certain viruses that can cause colds or things that feel like a cold with the upper respiratory symptoms, coughing, etc. You can get a little bit of a fever or some chills and just these feelings of body aches that make you feel better if you get under a blanket. And so if that's what you want to do, if that's what your body's telling you you need, then that's perfectly appropriate. It's not really super different in terms of whether it's summer or winter, in terms of what's going on in the picture. Adam, what are your thoughts?
You know, I'm not sure I'd ever really considered the kind of the difference between the viruses that cause flus in the summer and the viruses that cause or flu or colds actually really in the winter, because there are a lot of the same sorts of viruses. There seems to be a lot more of them in the winter than the summer, but you do see them. And I agree, Christy. I think we would treat them kind of the same in terms of comfort measures, you know, to reduce the fever because people are really uncomfortable when they're running a high fever. But if you go around and you don't have anything on you, you people start shivering a lot of times because they're just losing their heat and their body temperature is changing really rapidly. So I can imagine staying warm but not too warm because you throw a blanket on yourself, two or three blankets, and all of a sudden you really start getting your body temperature raising too high. So I don't know. I think this is a good one. Maybe we have our health sciences librarians. We'll do a little research on this, and maybe we can get back to you, and we can like post some information on our website about the viruses, because there are several different viruses that can cause the flu. Best thing, I think, is good hand washing, good hygiene, not being in front of people that are sneezing all over you.
And then what to do for when you get it are just the things that make you feel better, because it's mostly time that helps you get better.
I think a good massage from a loved one,
that sounds
neck
great.
And shoulders, can never go wrong.
Okay, let's take our very next house call question. Daniel?
My uncle recently had a basal cell carcinoma removed from his arm. He doesn't seem too worried about it coming back, but the fact that he's had a skin cancer makes me uneasy. Is there anything else he should be doing? And since we're related, should I get checked as well?
Well, maybe it's uncle on the other side of the family.
Yeah.
And you don't have any real genetic relations. Well, there is a little bit of genetic relationship here, but you know, the real biggest factors are not genetic unless you have one of these types of basal cell cancers where people get lots of them, and that's pretty rare.
Yeah. Most basal cell carcinomas are related to sun and age, and then there are other risk factors like smoking and certain chemical exposures and other things. But in terms of what he and what you should be doing, I mean, the biggest thing is for him to follow his body and notice if there's anything that's changing or growing or new and get follow-up for that. And also for both of you to continue to be avoiding the sun and wearing clothes and hats and all of those steps that we need to take to protect ourselves from sun damage.
One of the biggest things would be to wear sunscreen, an SPF of 30 or greater, and apply it liberally and frequently. Looking for things that have both UVA, ultraviolet A, ultraviolet B, and even ultraviolet C protection. So these are things that you can do, your uncle can do. And once you've had one, you probably need to be seeing your doctor, you know, more frequently, because you're likely to be getting another increases. Thank you for a question. What's our very next house call, Daniel?
I used to run competitively when I was younger. I'm trying to get back into training again, but my knee always starts to hurt after a few miles. I've been taking 3 to 4 ibuprofen every day to ease it, but I'm wondering if that can come back to hurt me later.
Well, first of all, good for you for getting back into training again and getting back to exercise if you'd been a period of time without it. That is a really important step, no pun intended. That was a cute pun, I thought.
That was very cute. It made me think of when I was younger, so much younger than
today.
Yeah, I mean, we're each thinking of different things, Christy. But what were you going to say?
I was going to say, per our previous research, if you have high blood pressure, then taking those anti-inflammatories every single day can be potentially harmful in terms of your kidneys.
Yeah, and I also think that you probably need to be doing physical therapy. Not even probably. You need to be doing physical therapy, because physical therapy is the kind of the great equalizer between young and old sometimes. And by the time you turn young to the time you turn old, it could be overnight. As I discovered sometimes, and your knees could start hurting. But doing physical therapy, I think, can delay it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, important to keep a watch on your weight and your nutrition, and to do as you're doing, an exercise to keep a healthy weight. And a lot of times that also just helps you be a little lighter on your knees. Let's take our last house call question, Daniel.
I always, always get sick when I come back from vacation. I go somewhere, usually by plane, and have a great time enjoying the nightlife of wherever I go. But when I come home, I'm instantly hit with a cold or the flu or a stomach bug. Am I allergic to fun? But seriously, are there any sorts of things I can do to prevent that post-vacation letdown?
This is funny to me because I have had the opposite problem. And it was something that my husband really got frustrated with me for very many years. Every time we would go on vacation, I would be so revved up trying to get through all my work to get to vacation. I'd get to vacation and let down, and then I'd be sick immediately on vacation. And so I've had to really work to try to prevent myself from being sick during my vacation. You're talking about being sick right when you get home.
And I was worried, Christy, because I thought where you were going with that was that you were allergic to having fun, and that's
the
opposite.
Exactly right.
So I was like, well, I can't help you with that one there. But, you know, I think that when we transition to something in our life, transitions are opportunities. When we open a door and we walk through it or walk out of it, it's into something new and different. And when these things are, you know, our bodies are kind
There's
of creatures of habit. We like it and it's exciting. And I always say, get a little bit more sleep.
Yep.
You know, get a little more rest. Take care of yourself. You can come back from vacation a day early and you can rest that next day. It's probably better than just running back into what you're doing because you may change time zones. You may change the types of foods that you're eating. And you certainly, for many people, change if you've been drinking alcohol.
Right.
Lots of changes.
That's part of it. And also being careful to wash your hands a lot and being just sort of aware of your surroundings on the plane for germs and just taking care of your body and then trying to prevent yourself from catching those germs.
Well, thank you so much for our house calls today, and we thank all of you for listening to Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you and your health. And if you want to share your own questions and stories, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or get our health app.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Steve Burris. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.